take full responsibility for everything this government has been doing in tackling coronavirus, and I'm very proud of our record.
Tens of thousands of our citizens have died avoidably. These were unnecessary deaths because of systematic government misconduct.
With good British common sense, we will continue to defeat this virus and take this country forward.
There are a lot of green shoots of opportunity on the horizon. You know, we've been held down on the forest floor for far too long, and we will reach that canopy again.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Sebastian Salek.
And a very good afternoon. I'm Roger Hearing. Now, Boris Johnson has warned intensive care units could be overwhelmed amid a surge in virus cases. The Prime Minister's promised to ramp up the vaccination programme, offering 24/7 COVID jabs as soon as possible. But Labour's leader, Keir Starmer, called on the government to explain why virus rules are not stricter.
When infection rates are much higher than last March, when hospital admissions are much higher than last March, when death rates are much higher than last March, why on earth are restrictions weaker than last March?
And you've got to consider the context as well. Wednesday, yesterday, seeing the highest number of daily coronavirus deaths since the pandemic began. The total now stands at almost 85,000, a figure that top scientist Professor Neil Ferguson sees passing 100,000 before we're done with all of this. But the King's College London epidemiologist said the virus rate is slowing and the number of infections are starting to level off in some parts of the country. So, Roger, early signs then that this lockdown may be working.
And we grasp at whatever signs of hope there may be. Well, joining us now is Tobias Elwood, a Conservative MP for Bournemouth East and chair of the Defence Select Committee. Tobias, welcome to the programme. Thanks for being with us again. First of all, this plan about 24/7 jabs, do you think it's realistic after the vast majority of people, or old or vulnerable, aren't exactly going to be able to come to a centre in the middle of the night?
No, you're right there. But this is the big light at the end of the tunnel. And the target by this government has to target those people who are the most vulnerable. So those old people over 80s in hospital and so forth, in care homes too. That program has been rolled out. So who would then apply to the 24/7? It would be the slightly younger age group. Because, of course, once you've had this vaccine, life does change. And the more we can get vaccinated, the quicker we can get back to some form of new normal. And you've heard that pharmacies are now joining the many places where you can get vaccinated as well. The program is well ahead. I think much as it's been, you know, a bumpy ride, there's no doubt about it, across the world, Britain can be proud. In fact, it's the rollout, the speed in which we're able to get these three types of vaccines we've not now got going out into the public.
Well, Tobias, I mean, on pharmacies, this is an interesting one. The government seems only to be enlisting 200 of them. Keir Starmer calling for all some 11,500 to be involved in the rollout. Why such a small number?
Understandable question to pose. When you get these batches of vaccine, they don't just come in, you know, individual groups. They come in, you know, big blocks of 1,000 to be able to actually have the economies of scale for this to be pushed out. The pharmacy itself must have the footprint, if you like, to be able to get these out very, very quickly. Otherwise, we're going to have them stacking up, not being used. And of course, getting them out as quickly as you can is so important. So the pharmacies that have got this up and running are the big giants, are the ones that can make sure that they're in the city centres, they're in the places of huge occupation, so they can be utilised. It's a logistical challenge, essentially.
Well, logistical challenges, of course, are meat and drink to the people that you often deal with, the Army, as you're wearing your hat as chair of the Defence Select Committee. The Army's already helping, we know. Could they actually help more of a speed up of the rollout, help the logistics go forward?
Yes, the one thing I know, Nadeem Zahawi, who's the Vaccines Minister, very, very well indeed, and the first conversation I had with him was, make sure you utilise the armed forces. They're the underutilised asset, in my view, across, you know, dealing with this pandemic, not just with the strategic thinking, but with the logistical rollout. And I'm pleased to see that we've got a Brigadier Prosser, we've got a 101st 101 Logistics Brigade helping with that delivery to make sure behind the scenes we've got the vaccination hubs that are developing, and also they've got the mobile centres being rolled out to make sure we get to the vaccines to the front line.
And, I mean, we know that they're already involved, as you illustrate. Is there room, as all of these plans to ramp up the sort of the output of the vaccinations comes into force, is there room for the Army to help further there?
Well, I think the logistical chain that's coming through here is how can, you know, the companies themselves produce the vaccinations, produce the vials, and us getting them out. So it has to be that happy medium between them coming from the procurement centres, being able to be distributed across the country in a timely manner. And as we move to 24/7, I think absolutely we'll be able to get to that point where herd immunity won't be far long round. But we need to recognise too that even though you've had the vaccination itself, you could still actually pick up the virus itself and pass it on. So we need to brace ourselves for it's going to be a number of months before we get back to anything like a new normal.
But then isn't the point that the reason we are in this crisis is simply because the rules are not strict enough? Keir Starmer made the point yesterday that we are in at least as desperate a situation as we were back in March, but the rules are less strict. I mean, we can hardly be surprised that the case numbers are going up so much. We need to tighten up, don't we?
Well, you just heard yourselves that on your opening remarks there that the infection levels are starting to plateau themselves, which is good news. So the not just the restrictions, but I think the vaccination is having an impact too. But it's a different scenario than back in March. It was very much an unknown then. We weren't ourselves disciplined. We weren't wearing masks. Compliance of the nation, of us all doing our bit, is so important. You know, keeping our economy open is so important as well as tackling the COVID-19, the pandemic itself. It's those three variables that any government needs to be able to balance to say, you know, are people going to abide by the rules? Are we going to lose so many jobs there'll be more problems afterwards? Are we able to contain the pandemic itself? Very difficult situation. But compare us with France, with Germany, Spain and Portugal. You know, we're pretty much on a parity there. What we are, where we're excelling, I think, is getting that vaccination program out as fast as possible.
Yeah, I mean, compliance that you touched upon is a really interesting one. And we've seen recently how difficult it's been to get people to continue following these rules almost a year into this crisis. What can we do to further that? I mean, there was some talk a few days ago about shock tactics, playing films on the BBC, showing what's going on inside these wards. Is that an avenue we should be going down to scare people into following these rules?
You make such an important point. It's been such a stress for the entire nation. There's pandemic fatigue, if you like. We're absolutely exhausted on this. What we need to recognise is that this is the final chapter. This is the last couple of months until the vaccination is able to make its mark. And this is where we need to dig deep, because as we're seeing with those numbers, I mean, they're quite horrifying. Record numbers of deaths every day. Our hospitals maxed out as well. Each one of us must do our duty. We must distance, must wear that mask, must abide by the rules, and we will get through this.
What about what's going on where in the area you represent, Bournemouth? I mean, you know, it is an area where an awful lot of people retire, therefore much older people probably in some cases. Also a place where people notoriously went last summer when they perhaps should not have done and crowded the beaches. What's the levels of the vaccination process there, but also what's the level there of people actually obeying the rules, of making sure they don't make things worse for what probably is a more than averagely vulnerable population?
Yeah, it is a more elderly population, you're right. Interesting you mentioned the beach itself. There's big pictures where people, you know, massed on the beach. We were worried that we were going to be that first place which would have to have, the second lockdown. In fact, it wasn't us, it was Leicester, and then we saw some outbreaks elsewhere. It actually proves something, that when you are outdoors, the movement of the pandemic is very, very different indeed than indoors. So we're fortunate in Bournemouth, in Dorset, to have lots of open spaces there, and we're blessed because of that. But ultimately, under the same pressures as other parts of the country, with much of our hospitals deluged by actual COVID cases themselves. And this is the consequence we need to recognise, because it isn't so much the COVID-19 that's the challenge, it's the fact that then it dominates the hospital focus, which means they can't actually deal with those other aspects such as cancer patients and so forth. And that's the dilemma that we need to face. We need to make sure that our hospitals are able to manage all those other operations that they're able to do, particularly during winter months, which is usually when the hospitals are under most pressure.
And Tobias, what about the business side of this? I mean, lots of local businesses in Bournemouth, of course, big holiday resort. Presumably they didn't have quite the same season last summer as they would have in other years. And now we're into low season. We've got this going on continually. And then what some would say is quite a stop-start incremental approach from the Chancellor. Are businesses managing to cope?
They're finding it very, very difficult indeed. And I'm pleased that the Chancellor has come forward to continue some of that financial support that started off over a year ago. I think we can be actually quite proud in what the Treasury has actually put forward. Its furlough scheme has been fantastic. There are the loans and the business rates, holiday continue, VAT referrals and so forth. that must continue until we're fully out of the woods here. If that doesn't, then I'm afraid the hospitality sector will be the sector that actually suffers the most. Going back actually to 2008, you remember the financial the disruption then, it was actually the hospitality centre that bounced back pretty quickly. They are the heart, if you like, of our communities. It brings people together. And boy, will we all need to be able to come together and to be able to mark the end of this, you know, once we're through it. So making sure we have that hospitality sector there in these last couple of months is so critical indeed. 3.5 million people employed. There's a whole supply chain that comes into it as well. And it's worth $63 billion, I think, to the economy every year.
And very briefly, Tobias, there may be big gaps in that come next summer, assuming anything's back to normal. A lot's already gone, I guess.
Well, this is the point, is how do you then revive? How do you make sure? Thankfully, the furlough scheme has kept the skill set there and available. But ultimately, this is why many of us are calling for a hospitality envoy or a hospitality minister to link together the concerns of this sector to make sure that we can not just deal with the immediate, which is getting those businesses back, but also paying back, because it's going to be 5 years, I understand, from some of the pubs and restaurants that I've spoken to before they get back to an even financial footing.
Let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. And Roger, we start with some potentially good news if you've had coronavirus.
Yes, that terrible phrase, herd immunity, because what's happening, it seems, a study into reinfection rates for the virus shows, that COVID gives, quotes, at least as good an immune defence against future infections as a vaccine. Researchers from Public Health England found previous illness provided about 85% protection against both asymptomatic and symptomatic reinfection, though they did find a small number amongst the group did get infected twice. Typically, they suffered a milder form of the disease even then. Now, with an estimated 1 in 5 people having been infected in this country, the findings suggest that herd immunity could already be slowing down the course of the pandemic. However, scientists warn they still don't know exactly how long immunity lasts.
And of course, it's not an invitation to be any less strict with yourself than you currently are. Just because you think you might be immune, don't go about your daily business. But of course, I don't need to tell our listeners that. And then we got this story around travel. The introduction of new coronavirus rules on international travels to the UK is being delayed from tomorrow until Monday, given a bit of time to prepare. So anyone arriving in England is going to need to test negative within 72 hours of their departure. That said, there could be a travel ban on flights from Brazil to stop a new variant of coronavirus getting into the UK. And then more widely, the speculation around what other countries could get hit. Brazil has a lot of borders, a lot of international borders with other South American countries. This strain of the virus apparently quite prevalent in the US as well. So this is a story we should be watching quite closely.
Meanwhile, Scotland's tightened its lockdown even further. Shops selling essential items now only allowed to offer click and collect. Collections must be outdoors, appointments staggered to avoid queuing. And these new rules also, it seems, include a ban on drinking alcohol outdoors. And it's all coming into force on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, given the weather I'm seeing at the moment, you wouldn't want to be doing anything outdoors. It pretty makes the situation even harder. But speaking of the weather, Boris Johnson aiming to achieve global net zero carbon emissions by 2050 in a crucial round of UN climate change talks hosted by the UK in November. The Prime Minister said efforts to drive down fossil fuel emissions represent a charter for jobs. COP26 then scheduled to run from the 1st to the 12th of November in Glasgow, and we recently saw Alok Sharma step down as business secretary to devote himself full time to making sure that that is a success.
Right, now let's talk about social media, because the power of social media and online influence has perhaps never been as apparent. The outrage that greeted Donald Trump's exclusion from Twitter, Facebook and YouTube is a sign of their ability to shape politics, and therefore, of course, the accusation that their banning of the president amounts to censorship. And that's just the open accounts, making no secret of their political views or affiliations. What about the secret world of influence hidden behind seemingly non-partisan tweets or YouTube videos? Well, the Oxford Internet Institute has just published its annual Media Manipulation Survey, and the headline is "Social Media Manipulation by Political Actors is Now an Industrial-Scale Problem Prevalent in Over 80 Countries. Well, let's discuss this now with the co-author of the report, Professor Philip Howard, Director of the Oxford Internet Institute. Professor Howard, thanks so much for being with us. A key finding that stood out to me is that private strategic communications firms are playing an increasing role in spreading what you call computational propaganda. Just tell us about that.
Yes, it's a big problem. I think in the early years of Twitter and Facebook, much of the misinformation was generated by military units in authoritarian regimes that had been retasked to doing social media. But now it's PR firms and political consultants in democracies that offer these very same services.
And then, Philip, one interesting term in the report is cyber troops. Who are they?
Right. So we study large groups of teams of people who do this kind of work. And these are formal organizations with receptionists, and they post job ads, and they have retirement plans. Sometimes they pay taxes, and they're in many countries around the world. And so these small teams maintain fake account profiles, sometimes hundreds or thousands at a time, and you can rent them to get your messages out at a key moment in public life.
Now, it's really interesting, the renting part of it. I mean, the amount of money that's being spent on this is quite startling, isn't it? I mean, just give us a sense of the kind of scale of this.
Well, it is pretty significant, and many of the labs that we've studied in our countries around the world, politicians are not actually their primary clients. It's pharmaceuticals firms that tend to pay for most of this kind of media manipulation. But on the whole, it's contracts can run to several hundred thousand pounds. They're used particularly during election time when a party or a politician needs to roll out a good social media campaign. And in most countries around the world, it's difficult to track who these hackers are and how much things cost. But yes, in an average year, there's tens of billions of pounds worth of contracting for this kind of activity generated around the world.
And I mean, who is getting involved with this? A lot of the time when we talk about this sort of activity, it's your Chinas, your Russias, your North Koreas. Does it go further than that?
Yes, and it sort of depends on the issue area you want to talk about. When it comes to COVID-related misinformation, these days the primary sources are the major media outlets from Russia and China, and they have particular messages they want to get out, right? Their messaging is that democracies are weak, that elected politicians can't make the tough decisions on health and healthcare. And Russia and China, the Chinese government, say their scientists are leading the search for a cure. The third thing is that often these media organizations promote Chinese aid, right? When they say and send ventilators or masks to the White House, it's Russia and China that's providing the world's aid to help get us through the crisis. These are the kinds of messages we see around COVID misinformation.
And just tell us what it would look like. So, I mean, if I were, say, receiving this kind of manipulation, what would I be looking at? How would it be working on me? What's the mechanism involved?
Well, it depends a lot on the platform, but I assume you're Twitter, perhaps use Twitter and Facebook, and so these messages would appear as something that's shared by someone in your social network. Maybe you followed them and they followed you back, but you weren't quite sure who they were. They might have been from high school, maybe a distant cousin, and they're not actually, didn't go to your high school and aren't a distant cousin, but and most of the time they post images of flowers and family pictures and talk about soap operas until they get hired to promote some particular politician or push a message. And that's when suddenly the accounts become political.
And surely some of the responsibility here has to fall onto the social media services themselves to police what is on the platform. A mammoth task maybe, but I'm seeing that certain of them are starting to add warnings. I mean, particularly Twitter over the US election, we saw quite prominently adding warnings. What more do we need to see from them to make sure that these accounts can't have undue influence?
Well, from my point of view, the main challenge is that the social media firms don't share information about what goes on the platform. Even compiling all the evidence for this report takes an enormous amount of work because they only really act when they're caught or when politicians turn the limelight on their activities. They tend not to be proactive or volunteer this stuff because it lowers trust in the platform. But ultimately, over time, you know, you get these crazy conversations, particularly on the far right. And I don't mean small C conservatives. I mean the ultra conservative white supremacist movements, especially in the U.S. and here in the U.K., will push stories that undermine the trust in the media, undermine trust in elections. And can end up producing violent outcomes like what we've seen in the U.S. over the last 10 days.
But is there a sense that, I mean, you, as they get more sophisticated, aren't the people, the children, if you like, of the internet age also getting more sophisticated in being able to filter some of this stuff? Aren't they just that bit more, maybe, social media literate than older people like myself?
Yes, we think that's happening. So there's some evidence that younger people are still consuming significant amounts of news, but it's much shorter news bites. So they're much more likely to quickly see headlines go by. They tend not to read 1,000-word investigative journalism pieces. And one of the problems on our side as citizens is that sometimes we forward content to our friends and family that we ourselves haven't actually read, or that we think is sensational and somebody else should see, but we don't vet it. And so social media firms need to step up their ability to serve the public interest. Long term, we as citizens need to get more sophisticated and not share stuff that clearly isn't well sourced.
The question then, I suppose, is how do you teach that? I mean, it's interesting having this conversation as a journalist, because everything I read, I'm trained to be very critical about and to understand what the source is and to understand how likely it is to be true. But that's not a skill that people pick up in school. And it's something that's becoming pretty essential if we are to live our lives out on the web. What's the best way of going about that?
Well, I agree with you. The long-term investment in media education, in early schooling, is critical. These are modern media habits, and there are several governments around the world. The Dutch are very good at early age digital media education. So the Canadian government. So that we know what these programs can look like, and integrating sort of tech savvy and media savvy into the curriculum is one good long-term investment in building to moral citizens.
And what about governments, briefly? I mean, are they well enough tuned into what's going on to take action at that level, quite apart from companies and children? I mean, what about the authorities?
So I have a two-part answer to that one. The first is that in most democracies, the national security services are pretty sophisticated. They are able to tell when a foreign government is attacking a national politician or trying to run some funny business. So the security services in most countries tend to be aware of what's going on. The tougher thing for democracies is that the people who pay for this stuff are usually politicians. And politicians tend not to vote for more fines on politicians. So in this country, we have a great elections administration, but they're understaffed and they're not well funded. And getting Westminster to vote in new rules for campaigning and to raise the fines, it's going to be a tough sell.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.